Union, the Yeshiva and Synagogues of Bergen County, the RCBC, NCSY, and our host institution, Ben Parat Yosef, would like to welcome everyone for an exciting, informative, and thought-provoking evening of positive Jewish parenting. This evening's program focuses on parenting preteens and teenagers, which began with practical workshops and will now be followed by a panel discussion led by outstanding mental health practitioners as they discuss raising young adults in this challenging world. Our panel includes Dr. Alex Bailey, Rabbi Yaakov Glasser, Mrs. Shawnee Gedgerman, Dr. David Pelkovitz, Rabbi Stephen Przanski, Rabbi Danny Rapp, Lauren Roth, and Dr. Nussin Westrich. My name is Hannah Farkas, and I have the privilege of working with and assisting Frank Buchweitz as his program associate. As many of you know, the concept of positive Jewish parenting programs was the inspiration of Frank Buchweitz, whom I have the privilege of working with in implementing tachlitic programs that touch the hearts of our families. The Orthodox Union has been in the forefront of sponsoring innovative programs whose core mission is to strengthen the Jewish family. Frank is unable to be with us this evening as he continues to recover from a serious illness. However, he's asked me to send you his warmest regards and hopes that the information you receive this evening, including the booklet of internet articles on the workshops presented, will enhance your knowledge and strengthen the bonds with your children. Our moderator this evening, who will present our panelists, is Dr. Nussin Westrich, an assistant professor at the University of Toronto Medical School. He's also on staff at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center, where he co-directs the Inpatient Adolescent Regional Unit and teaches both medical students and residents, and has served as director of NCSY for 10 years prior to his medical education, starting numerous youth initiatives. We thank you for your participation this evening and hope you'll join us for many more diversified programs in the future. You've each received an index card where you will be able to put any questions that you might have for our panelists, and they will try to be answered as many as possible, okay? The volunteers will be collecting them, so if you raise your hand, they'll come around and grab them, all right? Just a heads up, we will be having another program December 9th. At B'nai Yeshurun, and it's going to be called Teens and Spirituality. There'll be more information at a later point. All right, Dr. Westrich.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our panel and our interactive discussion this evening on how to respond to your adolescent or your teen about religious hypocrisy. And I'm not sure that it's really a question to be answered by mental health professionals. And that's why we have a very diverse panel here this evening of distinguished individuals, not only mental health, but also in the rabbinate. And this evening I'm going to be the moderator. My new friend here, Rabbi Glasser, pointed out that he's never been on a panel where it's a Darvish HaBegadusha. It's actually a minyan, and you could say Kaddish. So because of that, we have a large panel. I'm not going to really say much, but just introduce our members. The first individual is Rabbi Danny Rapp, and I'm going to ask each individual to around for two or three moments, and that's rabbinic moments, to give us your take on how to respond to adolescents about religious hypocrisy. Rabbi Rapp is a assistant professor of Talmud at the Irving Stone Beit Medrash program at YU and associate dean of undergraduate studies. He's also a dayan at the Beth Din of America, the RCA. Rabbi Rapp.
Thank you. You're probably wondering what I would know about this, and I've been wondering the same thing myself. So I'll just say a Dvar Torah, which is, I think, somewhat related to this. The Gemara in Chulin on Daf Kuf Yud has a very interesting story. It tells the story, the Gemara is discussing the issue of an udder, whether you can eat the udder of a cow. I'm sure this is something that keeps you up at night. So the Gemara talks about the fact that it's fleishik, it's got milk in it, is there any way to kosher it? So the Gemara tells us it's a machokas. Some people they do, some people they don't. So they tell us about this fellow, Rami Bar Tamri. He came from a town where they do, and he went on Erev Yom Kippur, he was visiting a town where they don't. So he needed something to eat, so he figured, nobody eats the udders, I'm going to collect them all from the garbage, and I'm going to go eat them myself. So he did that. They called him into court. Rav Chisda says, what are you doing? You're not allowed to eat these things. He said, but I come from a town where you do eat these things. They said, okay, but you're here now. You have to follow the Chumri Yemakum Shabal Hashem. So he says, I understand. That's why I walked outside of the Tchum and I ate it there. He said, okay, how did you cook it? He said, I found some twigs. They said, how do you know the twigs weren't of Yayin Nesach? So he said, they were there for 12 months already, I could tell, so it wasn't a problem. He said to him, ah, so how do you know they weren't stolen? He said, there's mold on it already. Therefore, I knew there was Yish, that they gave up hope. It was Hefker. He said, aha. But tell us, how come you're not wearing tefillin? He said, I'm not wearing tefillin because I have a stomach ailment. But how come you're not wearing tzitzis? He said, because this is a borrowed shirt. Therefore, it's not chayiv in it. He said, okay, you can go. Gemara goes on to say, as he walks out, they bring in another guy. It was a kid who was over Kibbutz Aveim, they're about to give him Malkus. So Rabbi Tami said, you can't give him Malkus. He said, because we know that there's a din, that any mitzvah that's matan tzchor b'tzidim, if the Torah tells us what the reward is, we don't give Malkus. So they said to him, you're a pretty smart guy. He said, come to my town, you'll learn a lot also. So it's a very strange agadah. What does one have to do with the other? Right? For starters, to go through the rest of the story with the Asa Mela, but to bring up who was next in line, why was that relevant at all? So I heard the following vort from Rabbi Yoel Schoenfeld, who heard it from Rabbi Moshe Rosenberg, who doesn't remember who he heard it from, but it wasn't his. It says as follows, and that's going to be maybe Gula Olam, you'll see. He says as follows, he says, think about what was going on here. This guy, one thing we know is it's Erev Yom Kippur. You have to eat because it's a mitzvah and B, because tomorrow's Yom Kippur. We know that the guy's so poor he doesn't own the shirt on his back. We know that he's sick. He has a stomach ailment. And we know that nobody invited him for a meal. And then when they find out about it, what's the reaction? They try to give the guy Malkus. How do you, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. So the end of the story is he turns to them and he says, you know what? You want to know why your kids are over Kibbutz Aveim? Because instead of being concerned about where my meal was, you're concerned about every chumra in the book. That's the point of the Gemara. Next.
All right, next. Since we're on the rabbi track, I'm going to introduce a rabbi who I think is well known to the community, Rabbi Brzezinski, who's the rabbi of B'nai Yeshurun, and is also an author of many well-known books. Rabbi Brzezinski, on this topic, please. How do you respond to the adolescent about religious hypocrisy?
Right. Well, I don't have as utterly profound a story as Rabbi Rapp does. So the ethicist is accused of doing many unethical things, a real scoundrel, and someone asks him, how is it possible that an ethicist should be so unethical? So he said, must a geometry teacher act like a triangle all the time? I don't quite know what that means. My son told to me last night, but the fact is we do expect our geometry teachers at least to know the principles of the triangles. I've never been as bothered by this question as others have, perhaps because I grew up in Muncie. I see there's one Muncieite here, and I must have heard over the course of my adolescence from Rabbi Wein maybe 50 to 75 times, never confuse Judaism with the Jews. The Torah is perfect. We never say Jews are perfect. In fact, Jews are imperfect. People are imperfect. So now we're stuck in a paradox that everyone knows that no human being is imperfect. Everyone knows that no human being is perfect, but nonetheless, when there's imperfection that's found, we become very surprised, if not horrified by it. But that's the very notion of people being imperfect, of people having defects and foibles and flaws. So that's the first lesson. If no one is perfect, we should not be surprised or shocked when we see imperfection. The second point is we didn't discover it in our generation. It's not something new. It's been a staple of literature for centuries. But beyond that, I'm glad Dr. Westridge mentioned my book, because in the last chapter of my second book, Judges for Our Time, which is a shameless plug on my part, I discuss in large part this issue of religious corruption, because it goes back to the sons of Eli HaKohen. The second parak of Shmuel Aleph, the Novi says, and the Gemara is quite explicit, that the sons of Eli HaKohen were completely depraved with the two vices that have afflicted clergymen and maybe even religious people generally since time immemorial: desire for power and for money. And both of them exploited their position in the Mishkan and Shiloh in order to gain access to money as well as to to exercise power, especially over women who would come to the Beis HaMikdash with their offerings after they had given birth. So in fact, it's a very common phenomenon, and related, in fact, it was one of the causes of the destruction of the Mishkan and Shiloh. So it's not anything new, but nonetheless, it becomes a problem from two perspectives. Just because it's not new doesn't mean that it has to be tolerated, and in fact, has to be uprooted. And when perceived, it has to be challenged. And it's especially critical in terms of a family and a home when children are exposed to it. Now, I think children might hear about it in the public domain, the rabbis or teachers or authority figures or politicians for sure, but children are most sensitive to hypocrisy in their parents, most sensitive to it. And many times we'll see that children develop questions about the authenticity of Torah and mitzvos because they see certain things in their parents that are completely not in consonance with the way the parents are preaching to them or trying to educate them. And as a pulpit rabbi, I think Rabbi Glass is the only other pulpit rabbi on the panel. You're not pulpit rabbis, right? The lesson I often try to convey to the parents in our shul is that if a child comes to shul, you schlep a child to shul, 4, 5, 6 years old, and the child sees you talking to your friend the whole time, it's not that the child will learn bad tefillah habits. That's true. And it's not only the child will grow in disrespect for the shul. That's also true. The child will grow in disrespect for the parent and the parent's religious standing. Especially, as I've seen innumerable times, a parent says to a child who starts to ask for something, shh, 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 and then goes back to talk to his friend. Children are quite perceptive in hypocrisy, sometimes even more than adults are, and therefore parents especially have to be very, very vigilant not to display any sign of hypocrisy. Admitting when one makes a mistake is part of that, as well as noting again to the child that Torah Hashem Tamimo, the Torah is perfect, but none of its practitioners are, and all we can do is strive to be better. Next.
Rabbi, thank you. And your book can be found where?
You're all invited to my house after davening tet.
Okay, so we've heard from two rabbinic figures. Now, looking on the spectrum, we're going to hear from a psychotherapist. Lauren Roth is a psychotherapist who works in private practice in a small city called Lakewood, New Jersey. Mrs. Roth.
Are you holding that one? Oh. Okay, I guess I'm going to be standing up. I'm not a rabbi, so it's really going to be only 3 minutes. You could time me, watch. So like Rabbi Przanski said, I cannot believe it. Look, I wrote it. Rabbi Wein said when I was a teenager, and I still remember it, he used to come and speak to us down in Memphis, Tennessee. He actually, the way I remembered it, and maybe he said it differently in Muncie, I think it was my father who said it because he heard Rabbi Wein so many times. Don't judge Judaism by Jews. So I want to make 3 quick points, and then I want to hear your questions much more than I want to hear myself talk. Do as I say, not as I do, doesn't work. That's number one. Now that being said, as Rabbi Przanski already said, parents and adults, other adults, are only human. And we will all make mistakes. The key is when we mess up, not if we mess up, but when we mess up, to be emotionally healthy ourselves, to be able to admit our mistakes. To be able to sincerely say, oh, I can't believe I did that. I really made a mistake. And you know what? I'll bet I hurt you. Tell me how I hurt you. You know, tell me about that because I really bet I hurt you when I did that. Tell me how I let you down. I'm willing to hear it. Don't judge Judaism by Jews. People are imperfect. Ein tzadik baretz asher ya'aseh tov velo yachda. There is no perfect person in the world who only does good and never sins. And finally, and part of the same point, when I work with teenagers and adults who are disillusioned with the Orthodox Jewish world, it's inevitably because some religious person hurt them and wasn't emotionally healthy enough to admit their mistakes. apologize and make it up to the person. Now, how many minutes do I have left? Because I would like to say something.
None.
None?
We'll give you an extra minute.
I'm so excited. I just happened to be reading this Shabbos, which is why it's marked with one of my kids' drawings, in Rav Hirsch. I can't believe it. It wasn't even this week's parsha. I just opened it up. Hashem gave this to me. The Torah never hides from us the faults, errors, and weaknesses of our great men. Just by that, it gives the stamp of veracity to the Torah itself. But in truth, by telling us about their faults, our great men are in no way made lesser, but actually greater and more instructive. If they stood before us as the purest models of perfection, then we would think they just have a different nature and we can't be like them. But because they're imperfect, we can strive to be like them. Did we not know that Moshe Rabbeinu could also fly into a passion, and his meekness and modesty would seem to us just to be his inborn natural disposition and lost to us as an example? Next.
Thank you very much. I think Frank Buchwatz, who put together this panel, did it quite wisely, and I think it's reflected by the various disciplines that are represented here. And next, we are going to hear from a woman who's been involved with Jewish education for the past 20 years at Berea High School, Mrs. Shani Gezerman.
Hi. Is this close enough? I guess I'd like to just address it from the teacher's perspective, and I'll mainly talk about maybe religious hypocrisy that exists in schools. First, I just think it's important to understand why the girls or the kids, the boys or girls, are so sensitive to religious hypocrisy and why they react so strongly to it. So just to kind of empathize a little bit with what it's like for them. Besides all the rules that a kid will have in his own family, besides all of God's rules, there's a whole separate category of rules that exist in schools. And I think we may have been hearing tonight about the clash of emerging independence with the teenage years and the need and the existence of rules. But part of this independence is intellectual independence, where the kids really want the rules to make sense. And whereas at home, in the family rules, we may be able to explain why the rules make sense, and in Torah rules, we hopefully can give them a context to understand the meaning behind them. In school, there are a lot of rules which are just rules of the school. Don't write in pencil. Don't wear sneakers. Tuck your shirt in. You have to come to the roller skating Malava Malka. Just rules which, you know, don't wear sweatpants under your skirt, which is a big problem for us. Meaning, it's not against the halacha. I'm allowed to wear sweatpants at home. A kid may not necessarily understand this whole new body of rules. They understand that school is part of rules. But the desire for them their intellectual emerging abilities make them want to really get why these rules are so. So when a kid says, why do I have to? Why should I? Who cares? It's not just motivated by anger, although it may be motivated by anger, but it's also a real question. Why should I? Why do I have to? And aside from the general rules of a school, each teacher puts rules and expectations on kids, which, and these rules could really make their life hard. Memorize paragimel. Rewrite this essay. You know the Chavdalet Sifrei Tanakh. And a kid will, you may often hear your kid say, I'm not going to be a teacher. Why do I have to know this by heart? I'm not going to be a scientist. Who cares if I know these chemicals? And they don't understand it. They don't want to do it. So given this reality, it's common for kids to feel a sense of mistrust to all these teachers and adults in general who put all these rules on them, and they wonder, is this about me? Is this for my good? Is this about your reputation? Is this about caring just about how your school looks? And I think, you know, I've heard Dr. Pelkovitz say many times, rules without relationships equals rebellion, and I understand that in a family, that's extremely vital. You need relationships in order for your rules to make sense. But in schools, you also need relationships, and it's harder to develop relationships in schools between teachers and students. A teacher may see a kid as little as 40 minutes a week. So that doesn't mean that it's not necessary. We need to develop relationships with the kids and as much as possible. And the burden of proof for caring is really on the teacher. When I walk into a class in the beginning of the year, there's a lot of suspicion. Are you gonna make my life really difficult? Am I gonna hate what you're gonna tell me? And it's really incumbent upon me to create this context where things that I say are understood as being in their best interest. Given this climate, I think when there's a teacher is caught in an inconsistency, it gives a sense of outrage to the kid. How dare you, when you tell me all these things and I have all these rules, how dare you not keep them yourself? And there's a lot of pain. There's a lot of pain. There's a lot of anger. And the bigger the inconsistency, the more strong the reaction. And there's a tendency to be very black and white. This teacher said something that embarrassed somebody in class, and she talks about Benazon Chavero, and how could she embarrass this? And goodbye to the teacher, all her Torah, everything she's ever said. Goodbye, the baby with the bathwater. There's a sense from the outreach. There's a sense of being very black and white. And I think that as teachers and as parents, it's not only true in school, but in general, it's helpful to help the kids see a whole picture of a person. Unfortunately, there is tremendous opportunity for growth from the failings of other people, which are all the time. And you know, like I'm sorry, I'm taking very long.
No, you're doing wonderfully, wonderfully well. But what we want to do is just kind of make some introductory comments so we can create some interactive. And I think your perspective as a teacher has been very, very important, and your remarks are well taken. Just in the because we want to move on, I have the pleasure of introducing Rabbi Yaakov Glasser, who actually wears two hats. He's the Rav of the Young Israel Psaic, and as well, he's the regional director of NCSY Eitz Chaim region. So Rabbi Glasser, you can borrow the mic. You have to give it back then.
Okay, good evening. Even though I'm a rabbi and I'm an expert at repeating, I think a lot of what's been said has a lot of wisdom, and so I don't want to just reiterate the points that have been made, but I want to sort of give a sense of perspective. I spend a tremendous amount of time talking to teenagers, and I find that this issue comes up a lot. I find that it depends on what type of kid you're talking about. For kids that have a very strong religious identity, for kids that have managed to work through a lot of their religious issues and are coming at Yiddishkeit with a strong foundation, they are struggling more with the, you know, once in a while you'll read in the paper, you'll hear of an individual, and how is this possible? It kind of shakes their sense of equilibrium. How is it possible that this religion that professes so many wonderful ideals, that the people who embody this religion and these ideals could behave in this way? And it kind of rocks the stability of their world. For the kid who's less inspired, I think we have to appreciate what I often hear from them is they feel extremely overwhelmed by the expectations of religious life. They feel extremely overwhelmed by the degree to which at 16, 17, 15 years old, when their bodies and their social worlds and their Facebook and everything is pulling at them to walk into this world of pleasure and enjoyment and hanging out and no rules and no regulations and to just kind of indulge in that world. And our world of Yahadus is placing upon them a whole framework of expectations and demands and rules and regulations, and it's very, very difficult for them. And what makes it most difficult for them is when they look around them and they feel like the environment itself, the system itself, is not really sustainable, because when they look at the people around them who are them in 20 years, they don't feel like they're really able to always hold it together in terms of the expectations that are there of them. So one of the things that they are struggling with is whether or not not buying into the system altogether is something that's really sustainable. They're asking themselves whether or not committing to davening, committing to tefillah now, and giving up all of the different things that are pulling at me in terms of their attractiveness, whether or not that's really realistic in terms of, you know, the rest of my life. And they struggle because they look in the world and they see, as Rabbi Przanski explained, they see whether it's their parents, whether it's other parents, whether it's just a community at large, they see that the struggle goes on and that for some of us it is it's extremely difficult. I also think that it's important, and I think what they're looking for is a dialogue on this, is for it to be opened up. What they mostly talk to me about is that no one's discussing it, no one's mentioning it. It's like not, it's not a topic at the Shabbos table, a sort of a self-reflective acknowledgement that it's difficult, that it's challenging for a parent, for an adult, it's challenging for all of us to keep Shabbos for 25 hours in a meaningful and spiritual way. It's challenging for us to sit through davening for 3 hours in a meaningful way. And the greater degree that we have a sense of openness, that we can open that up and create a dialogue and create a sense of communication, a sense of validation of those struggles, the more that they will begin to see what they perceive as some of the religious hypocrisy as well-meaning people struggling themselves with trying to come to terms with the expectations of Judaism and the reality of their lives. So that's my comment.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was very good. I'd like to introduce now Dr. Alex Bailey. He's also a psychologist. In particular, his area of interest is in communication and relationships, so perhaps you have an interesting perspective on this topic.
I think between the men and the women up here is the one person without a jacket on. I hope that won't affect the words that come from me. I'd like to just very briefly hit on two areas, one from each of actually the two workshops that I gave earlier tonight in different contexts that relate directly to our issue tonight. I'd like to start by reading just a very brief letter to you that came out about a year and a half ago from one of the yeshivot in the tri-state area. It goes as follows. These past weeks, we've all been shocked to hear of two horrific accidents involving students from our broader community. In one, a senior was texting while driving and brought about the brain death of a bicyclist. In another, a student driving recklessly with only a learner's permit killed his friend's sister. I'm sure that we speak to our children about safe driving, but we also need to have a discussion with ourselves. Our children learn not only from what we say, but what we do. If our children see us texting while driving, they think that such conduct is acceptable. If our children see us get into a car without fastening our seatbelts, they learn that it's not dangerous to be in a car with a reckless driver. If our children hear us say that they should never ride with a person who texts, they will learn it's unacceptable. And if our children see that we protest and leave a car immediately when the driver is texting or speaking on the phone, they learn that such conduct is absolutely intolerable. It's uncomfortable for a high school student to get out of a friend's car because his or her friend is not driving responsibly. It's difficult to convince one's child to be brave enough to do so. Let us talk to ourselves and our children about what constitutes safe and unsafe behavior. The extension from this into our religious life is no surprise and shouldn't be much of an extension at all. When we tell our children the value of honesty, and then the phone rings and we tell them, pick it up and tell them I'm not here. When we tell our children that Lashon Hara is something unacceptable according to our values, and they hear us talking both at home and in shul. When we tell our children that davening is important and a value that we must have and hold high, and we get to shul whenever we get to shul, that models an incredibly important model to our children. Whether we like it or not, we're models to them. And we must hold on to that as the origin of, I believe, the religious hypocrisy. The other thing to keep in mind is we have to understand where our teenagers are coming from. This is something that was touched upon by Rabbi Glasser as well. Adolescents are sophisticated, most of the time. They're concerned with fairness and justice, and they like to argue and to understand why they do what they do. We can't get away with saying to our kids, when they ask us why we do something religiously, well, because it's in the Torah, we have to do it. That may be a good enough reason for us. It doesn't work for our teenage children. We need to be ready to discuss and to share our thoughts with our kids. And we need to be able to say to them, I don't know the answer, but let's investigate. And whether that investigation involves a rabbinic authority, whether that investigation involves sitting with our kids and learning, we are open to investigate. When we share with our kids, when we take them on the level that they're at, then we're able to fight the hypocrisy that we're potentially trying to keep them from. I'm done.
Okay, thank you. Our last panelist, I think is well known to many of you, is Dr. David Pelkovitz. He's the chair of Jewish education at Yeshiva University. He was a professor at NYU, has co-authored a number of books, and I also think brings a very interesting perspective as being a child of a rabbi, and I wonder if you can perhaps bring some of that perspective into it as well.
Okay.
Did I put you on the spot?
I'd forgotten about that.
You forgot about that. Okay. We can talk about that later if you
maybe
like.
Later. Okay, yeah. Great. Was fascinated to read a book that came out just in the last couple of weeks from the Harvard Business School about a new field called behavioral ethics, and it makes some fascinating points based on recent research in psychology and in other fields that study ethics. One of the main points it makes is that hypocrisy, religious hypocrisy, or hypocrisy in general, is sort of built in to the way we are, the way we think, the way we feel. Moral knowledge and moral action are two totally different things. Turns out, you ask the average American if they would behave ethically in a given situation, the vast majority of people describe themselves as being above average ethically. Almost everybody feels that they're honest, they're ethical, they're consistent, and we get very judgmental about hypocrisy in others. The reality, though, is that when we go into situations where we actually are tested by day-to-day life, it turns out it's much more difficult than we think, and we're often not even aware of our own hypocrisy. I just wanted to touch on that for a few minutes. Turns out, new research is showing is that there are two distinct systems that are going on. One system described as the should system, the other system described as the want system. The should system is the system that we all know about. What should we do in a given situation? It's what the Shulchan Aruch tells us about how to treat each other in terms of honesty, in terms of ethics, both about our Bein Adam L'Mokom and our Bein Adam L'Chavera. The one system is what happens once we're actually in situations that challenge us, ambiguous situations, the kind of situations that life is filled with. There, it's a different part of the brain that takes over. It's much more emotional. We're much more likely at that time to forget the should systems and to sort of do what we want, especially if we don't prepare for it ahead of time. Turns out that our ability to overcome that natural tendency towards hypocrisy is based on our ability to teach our children how to be ready for the realities of life. Consistent ethical behavior is much tougher than we think. And we often are just not aware when we do the very thing that we condemn others for doing. And I see it all the time. It's sometimes amazing to me how little awareness we have. I hear people, as the son of a rabbi, I'll tell you one thing. My father would often tell me that he would dedicate a speech to a specific group of people in Shul who he felt needed mussar in a certain area. And he'd look at them the whole time. And he'd say, you have to work on this, you have to work on that. And he'd have them specifically in mind. He says, invariably, that group would line up after davening. They'd say, Rabbi, best speech you ever gave. We know exactly the kind of people you're talking about. And they had no idea that he was talking about them. And that's human nature. The antidote is clarity of goals. The antidote is to become more mindful about these ambiguous choices. To the extent that we teach that, we probably really can get better at being more consistent ourselves and being able to prepare our children for a life of ambiguity. Viktor Frankl said it best. He said, between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space lies our choice. In that space lies our growth. And that's something we have to think about. It's something that we have to be more mindful about. And again, I think the bottom line here is the first thing we have to do is look at ourselves, look at that nekudas habechira, understand that it's tougher than it seems, and we have to do a better job of preparing our children. I'd recommend this book. It talks about very specific kinds of, some of you may have read about it in David Brooks' column in the New York Times just this past week. It's called Blind Spots by Max Bazerman. And it has very specific recommendations on how to overcome this. Every one of them totally consistent with the Musar Masters tell us about consistency and avoiding hypocrisy.
Thank you. So we have a number of questions that have been put forward. And as the evening proceeds, we'll be here through around 2 o'clock in the morning. You can bring forward some more questions. The first question is directed to you, Dr. Palkovitz. And it's a developmental question. It says, how do you talk to your adolescents about issues when their prefrontal cortex is just developing at that point, so it's hard for them to reason properly? So from a developmental perspective, I mean, we've said some interesting things, but how do you talk to a youngster about these kinds of nuances?
Okay, I think, again, it's in a way what my last talk was about to many of you, which is that the key is, because their work's in progress, because they're in a state of temporary insanity, as their brains are temporarily going offline and are under construction, we need to talk not in the heat of the moment. We need to have planned discussions with them. We need to really do a lot of listening, and they're more likely to take in our message if it's in the context of a close relationship, as been said before.
Okay. Anybody else want to talk about that from developmental? Yes. Dr. Bailey.
I would add that we also know that developmentally, just because children are not there yet doesn't mean we don't challenge them to get them there. We work with our kids and we talk to them about things that they may not yet be ready to understand or be ready to fully comprehend, as a way of challenging them to think in a more sophisticated way. And part of brain development happens, we talk about brain development from necessary and sufficient. Is the brain ready to grasp what it is? And if it is ready, we then have to produce and challenge it with things to make it advance and develop more. So while we have to be careful what we present to our kids, I do think that challenging them helps to develop that part of their brain in a more sophisticated way.
Okay. So we have a number of questions about rabbis. It seems to be... Okay, Rabbanim HaChashuvim. One question that's been put forward is, how do you respond to your child when he or she points out that a well-known rabbi or a Talmud Chacham is not treating others with respect? And comes home and tells the parents this. Huh? What do you tell them? The dayan or the rabbi?
Right. It's a good question. I mean, it goes back to what I said before, firstly about recognizing that they're no perfect people. And therefore, there's a danger, in fact, in identifying with the personality wholly and completely of any person, whether rabbi or leader. It reminds me, Rav Kook wrote in a very controversial statement that many of his Talmidim held was intended for the Hasidic movement, that he finds it very dangerous if a person completely becomes subservient to any individual, because he will absorb both his good midos and his bad midos. Recognizing, in fact, that Rabbanim, like other human beings, will also have bad midos. Now, granted, it's often easy to conceal them under the veneer of Kavod HaTorah, sometimes Kavanah Torah becomes too personalized. It becomes more Kavod Atzmi than Kavanah Torah. But nonetheless, if that framework is used, then from the perspective of the sinner or the Baal Midos Ros, it could be quite a defense to what he's doing. He's really fighting God's battles and not his own battles. But again, just the recognition that people are flawed, and sometimes people lose their temper. Sometimes people will engage in a battle for God's honor in the wrong way, using the wrong weapons and saying the wrong things. That's also part of life, recognizing that no one is perfect. I should say one other thing. You know, just the Gemara says that if Imarisa Tamar Chacham, if you see a Tamar Chacham sin at night, then Al Tar Achrav Bayom, do not murmur against him or suspect him by day, because Vaday Osa Tshuva, he definitely repented at night. Definitely might be a stretch, but I think part of it is the recognition that Don Lekaf Schus is also an issue. And unless we know absolutely, positively, unequivocally, that there's no possible justification for what he did, we should also raise the possibility that we don't have all the facts. Nonetheless, can't answer every case, and we have to learn from people's mistakes. I have a little cartoon on my refrigerator from the Wall Street Journal, which a fellow says to another, "I love learning from people's mistakes, and you've been a real boon."
Okay. There are a number of questions, and I'm going to synthesize them, really, because there are at least four or five questions. They're referring to a very sensitive topic in the community, and I'd ask both the rabbanim, the teachers, as well as the psychologist. You know, over the past number of years, there have been a number of cases of teachers or rabbis, even, who've been in respected positions, who've been accused or convicted of molestation, and that in particular, how do you respond to your children about that? That was a question that a few people asked, so I don't know who wants to tackle that question.
Why are you looking at me?
We'll try someone else. We'll come back to you.
Anybody
here want to deal with that?
You mean the question is how to respond?
How to respond to your, you know, I think that's
from. To me, the reality of the fact that at times there are teachers who abuse. By the way, it's I don't know that there's any evidence that there's greater risk, except that any profession that works with children might have a somewhat higher kind of percentage. But I think the key is to use it as a teachable moment. The research shows that to the extent that we're able to be honest with our children about the reality of the possibility of abuse, and we're able to talk to them without frightening them and scaring them about how to handle it if anybody does something to them that they tell to keep secret or makes them feel uncomfortable, that just those kinds of conversations, honest conversations with our children, actually will often work. It often does give them a script that they could follow. I can tell you about many times where I've known that parents' ability to talk to their children about prevention really does lead to the kids stopping the abuse at the very beginning. And even if the abuse goes on, there's some fascinating evidence that it has less of an impact because the kids felt somewhat prepared for it. So anytime we hear about abuse at the hands of members of the leadership of our community, again, I would grab on it as a teachable moment and a chance to tell our kids, look, it could come from anywhere. Most leaders and most teachers are not going to do it, but anybody who touches you or treats you in a way that feels inappropriate, the first person you should come to is me. And I think that will change it from nisayon to nes, from a trial and tribulation to a banner we could hold high that becomes growth-inducing instead of paralyzing.
So, Dr. Palkovich, you're responding to this particular question as an after the fact. In other words, the child has come to you and, you know, has recognized that something inappropriate has happened. I'd like to ask you, or members of the panel, do you think that there's an obligation before the fact, as the child's growing up, to somehow educate them, sensitize them as this being a possibility? And furthermore, what are the risks of doing that to children? Will you in some way diminish the role of the teacher or the rabbi by doing that?
Yeah, well, I think that it is the obligation of every parent to have this conversation with their kids. But not to say right from the beginning that this is something that's likely going to come from your rabbi or from your teacher, because actually the research doesn't show that at all. I mean, I've done some studies in this area where we've looked at this in various ways. And in fact, in the Orthodox community, it's actually more likely to come from somebody the child knows, but it might be from a cousin, be from a bunch of other areas. Mm-hmm. It's not, so we should talk to our kids, but say it could come from anybody. And it's more likely to come from somebody the child knows, but I think that absolutely, it should come before, not after. Absolutely.
Can I say something?
Yeah, sure, please. Mrs. Roth. Yeah.
Sorry that I have to stand, but it doesn't reach. I wanted to wait until Dr. Pelkovitz said his piece, because there was a way I was going to answer before him. There's one part that he didn't say, which I just thought would be helpful. After the fact, the research does show that if a child is sexually abused, the thing that helps them the most in terms of being resilient is being able to talk to their parent, being able to go to their parent, knowing that their parent is going to believe them, and more than that, the parent actually believing them. Once it happens, for the child to be able to go to the parent to believe them, and the parent to say, tell me more about it, so they talk about it more, because parents believing them, and then children talking about it again and again with the parents or in therapy, that's what helps afterwards.
Can I add 10 seconds? My wife is in the audience. I remember vividly the night before each of our children left for summer camp for the first time, and the first 5 times, my wife would have a talk with them about appropriate interaction, inappropriate interaction, and it became so redundant that one of his friends mentioned this at his ufruf. Every year he would have the talk.
Anybody else on the panel would like to? Sure.
I just wanted to, because I think one of the things that was brought up is, does this undermine the, in some way, the stature of the people that are working with the kids? At every NCSY convention, I stand up at the beginning of the Shabbaton, and I tell all the kids that this is a great Shabbaton, and there are a lot of people here that are here to inspire them and to work with them and to teach them, and that if anything were to happen at the Shabbaton that made them uncomfortable in any way, that these are the different people in the environment that they could come to talk to and to share that information with. And for that brief millisecond, I do. I expose that potential possibility for every authority figure in the entire room, including myself, because I don't identify myself as the person to necessarily come to. And I don't find that it diminishes anybody's stature at all. I don't find it breaks down the trust at all. I find the kids have come to accept this as a understandable part of reality and a part of society. It's become a very natural part of the Shabbaton. Thank God there's never been a major issue, but there has been in my time, but there has been there have been, you know, slight things that kids were uncomfortable about, and they did come forward and they did say something, and you are able to deal with it. I agree that I think it is something to be normalized, and I don't find that it undermines kids' ability to look up to their rabbis and look up to their teachers, and I think it is important.
We actually just have an opportunity just for a few more, moving on to a different topic, but again, referring to the teacher. What happens when your child comes home and repeats to you something that the teacher has said, which is very outrageous, or as this particular questioner said, keneged HaTorah? So what do you do with the teacher? Do you undermine the teacher? Do you correct the child? What do you do in such a situation?
As a parent?
As a parent, yes. Not as a teacher, as a parent.
I just had this exact situation this past Shabbos. My daughter was in 11th grade, came home and said something that the teacher said, which I did find outrageous, but this is the one teacher in the school that really has her attention, and it was like a very precarious predicament.
But I did tell her that she, you know, this teacher's personal hashkafa, which she's not saying something halachic. She may be interpreting halach according to her hashkafa, and it's important for her to weigh different hashkafas so she can come to her own personal relationship with Hashem and her own hashkafa. So, again, I think it's, you know, we don't have to, not everything a teacher says is needs to be accepted wholeheartedly by a kid, but we have to help them see people as whole people. And this teacher has this outrageous perspective. And, you know, there are other perspectives that you really admire in this teacher. So this one understands in context of a bigger picture and help her move towards what she feels, what is it going to, a conversation can ensue based on what was so disturbing about the perspective.
I work in a high school. I work as a teacher and as a guidance counselor. And I think one of the greatest gifts that we can give our children is to teach them to be advocates for themselves. When we train them and teach them to question, that it's okay to question, and we teach them how to question, that's a tool that will last for a lifetime. I think that something very important that Lauren Roth said a moment ago was we have to show our kids that we hear them. We have to not trust our instinct sometimes. Our instinct very often on the one hand is that the teacher couldn't have said that. You know, sometimes we need to be able to hold back from that and go with the other instinct. Would my child make this up? But which way we go, we have to teach our children and tools to advocate, help them. Who's going to question this? Who's the most appropriate to ask, rather than trying to solve the problem ourselves for them? It's something that I think extends way beyond simply dealing with a teacher who may or may not have said something, but helps them to then be able to in any number of positions and situations.
Rabbi Rapp, do you believe that the system, or should they, where children are question authorities?
Interesting. A few things. I think it's very important that a school for your child ensure that the school is for your background. Oftentimes, if the teacher says something outrageous, because that's what the school stands for. Speak to a lot of parents about Israel, about before and after they send their children to Israel. Many of them are shocked. I sent my son to Israel, and all of a sudden he doesn't want to go to college. Which yeshiva did you send him to? I sent him to the yeshiva where the neighbor's kid went. The neighbor's kid seemed to be happy. You send your kid 6,000 miles away, and you had no idea the fact that nobody there has ever gone to college, and they burned the Israeli flag on Yom HaTzmaut. That's the only time they'll ever see an Israeli flag. And now you're shocked that your child has come back with a different hashgafa than they went with. So similarly, it goes at all school levels, that in the event that you are going to send your child to a school which is either more religious or less religious than you are used to, then it's not surprising that you're going to have some issues. Now, you may think it out and say, well, I still, despite the fact that I'm not totally comfortable with it, I'm going to send my child there for reason X, Y, or Z, either because of the secular education or because it's cheaper, whatever the reason you come up with. So that's the case. I think that a person has to stick with the teachers. That I think the danger of getting up and saying your teacher is an idiot and thereby tearing down everything that the teacher has or will ever build outweighs whatever the statement was at the time. The previous panelist said that this Shabbos they had an issue with the teacher saying something outrageous. This is a weekly issue that I have. My children are younger, and you know, many low-grade teachers are very educated, but not all of them. So, therefore, we'll end up with Avram being the wrong age when Sarah gives birth, have issues like that. So what we usually do is we usually call the teacher, and we say, there seems to be a typo, right? Instead of writing 23, you meant to write 100, right? And the teacher will correct it in school there afterwards. The teacher hates us. Such is life. I think that's the key. I think the key is that there has to be the same words. There has to be support of home coming from the schools and support of the schools coming from the home. And in the event that you're in a situation you're going to run into problems, work it out with the teacher, not in front of the children.
Can I say something?
Yes, you can.
All right.
You're going to agree or disagree with
Mother,
rabbi?
May I? No, I agree with everybody.
Okay.
I agree with everybody.
You don't have to.
I agree with everyone. I was reminded with this weekly issue that everyone's talking about that one time my daughter came home with a story that her teacher told, and we were all listening to the story. It sounded so interesting. And then at the end she said, I don't remember what the story was, something like, I don't know, this woman got married and then she decided she wanted to go to the movies on Shabbos, or her husband decided he wanted to go to the movies on Shabbos. And we're listening, we're hearing what's going to be in the story, and something like, I don't know, at the end she killed herself instead of staying with him or something horrible. We just all went, we didn't mean to, you know, we didn't mean to be disrespectful, but it was something so shocking. We were like, that was just our first knee-jerk reaction. So yes, I agree, that's not a very good reaction. I always say we have to acknowledge our mistakes. So what did we do thereafter? It was really very healthy. We were sorry that we had been so disrespectful towards the teacher, and we said, wow, that's really interesting story that your teacher told. That's not the ending that we would have expected. So, you know what? Let's go around the table, and everybody, that's the situation. Someone got married, and then their husband wanted to go to the movies on Friday night. Finish the story. And every single person around our Shabbos table finished the story in a different way, and we all learned so much from it. It was a really good exercise.
Thank you very much. We're actually going to conclude, and I want to thank the various panel members for dealing with this. And the last question, which I'm going to answer very quickly, is religious hypocrisy really the most important issue we should be dealing with? And the answer is no. It's probably not the most important thing. But I think that what you've heard this evening from our various panelists is that as we moved into the 21st century, our community has been confronted with new issues. And I think that in many ways, the Dayanim, the Rabbanim, the teachers, the psychologists are very much responding to and very much in sync with how we should be as parents and how our children should be taught to deal with sometimes very difficult and complicated situations. We thank you all for coming this evening. We thank our panelists. And we'd like to tell you as well that there is a very special program sponsored by NCSY and the OU on teens and spirituality. It'll be a conference held on January the 8th at B'nai Yishurun Congregation. Shavua Tov, Gutavach, and a safe ride home.